Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. You can always reach us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Jojo Capice, the author of Bella Figura and also All Roads Lead to Rome, her first novel. So she's ready with her second and would love to talk to you all about her novel and Italy. Jojo.
Buonasera, buonasera. Thank you for inviting me to the Commonwealth Club. It's wonderful to be back. And I'm tonight launching my latest novel, Bella Figura. Bella Figura. Bella Figura. It rolls on the tongue. Bella Figura. What does it mean? It means to always have your first impression be the best. It means that people will remember you, what you wore, how you look, how you stand. And it is an idiomatic expression that toddlers learn early. Oh, there's my sound man. Toddlers learn early to give positive reinforcement to little ones. Make a beautiful impression. Put your best foot forward. Be beautiful. Think beautiful thoughts. Because when we do, we make a wonderful impression on everybody, every day, everywhere. The phrase bella figura is beautiful, not like the antonym brutta figura. Nobody wants to be ugly. Bella figura lets us view ourselves beautifully, life in each other. Also how we view countries and imagine our future. But look at the news. Let's just look at this for a moment. We have some very intelligent journalists writing about things of today. The Economist, race, color, and caste. We have here the Financial Times, Washington, a tale of two cities. We have the New York Times, Digest, workers claim bias being hired. And lastly, the outlooks of how the Pope colors the world. The new Pope, that is. Well, I couldn't ignore this. I couldn't ignore prejudice. But before I describe my book and we go into prejudice, I want to speak more positively about other things. Let me speak about my fascination of all things Italian. And even with the jumble of the wonderful, exciting, naughty boy, the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, and his bunga bunga parties, and the many cases for misconduct, I want to tell you he is one of the great characters of today. And we must enjoy him because we're going to tell our great-great-grandchildren about this man. And we might also discuss the Pope, the old Pope. Why, after 567 years, does a boy step down from a throne like that? He didn't have a terminal illness. He's taking piano lessons so he doesn't have dementia. And what about the butler? I mean, the butler forever silenced by the Vatican. So these are questions to think about as I speak to you today about Italy and other things. But I want to forget these problems and sweep some things away. But how can one forget the debt crisis? And how can one forget that this new pope, with all due respect, told corporations they have got to bail out the poor starving people in this world? I was waiting for him to say, we're going to clean up the corruption in the Vatican Bank and bring something really sparkling to the world's economy. But anyway, I'm going to forget that now, and let me just come with you to Capri in Italy, the wonderful land of where the Renaissance is the birthplace of the Renaissance, a country where my novel is set. 60% of the world's greatest art is in Italy. Delicious food, dazzling geography, musical language, a language that began opera in the 1600s and inspired some of the greatest composers. Let me speak of romance, one of my favorite subjects, and Italy's great composer, Verdi. This is the year of Italian culture in San Francisco. And to celebrate Verdi's 200th year of his birth, a birth from a tavern owner whose young son, at the age of 8, sang on the streets because his father owned a broken-down harpsichord and he wanted a piano. A man who learned a lot about bias when he grew to be a young gentleman trying to compose music and get into the best conservatory in Milano. And he couldn't get in because his age was wrong, so he suffered age bias. His finances were wrong. And there was a class discrimination. But he was a genius of musical composition. Even though he surpassed that prejudice, went on to study with some great masters, and he then experienced an enormous tragedy. His two children died before they reached the age of 3, and his wife, who was the love of his life, died at 26. At the pinnacle of despair, when he wished to give up composing, he wrote Nabucco. And then, in his lifetime of 88 years, he wrote 30 other operas. Rigoletto, Il Trovatore, La Traviata, Aida, La Forza del Destino, Othello, just to name a few. A man who uniquely communicates through his scherzos and arias the deepest of human feelings, extravaganzas of brilliance. While he endured adversity, jealousy, he still bequeathed to us his musical genius. His complex mind that contained secrets had love stories too. He had a mistress and was shunned by Milanese society because of her. A child was born out of wedlock. And also the surprising fact, when he had a lot of money and Vanity Fair was putting his picture in their magazine, he disowned his own father. La 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 la. La 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 la. I'm trying to audition for the opera at the same time. San Franciscans will experience the beautiful music of Verdi at our opera house this October, under the direction of our Italian music director, Maestro Lisciotti. An unparalleled event will take place when the San Carlo Opera House will visit with their bevy of performers, joining forces with our stars and create a double chorus for Verdi's incredible Requiem. The date is October 25th. I don't think the tickets are on sale yet, but put it on your calendar. Verdi's music will astound the ear, just as he intended, creating a sound as if the wrath of God descended directly to the listener, threatening hell. A wildly melodramatic sound, exciting with thrills and thrills of allegro notes, to let heaven and earth combust in our hearts. Less than 1 week after this extraordinary opera made its debut, Verdi died of a stroke. The drama of Verdi. Born a Catholic, sympathetic to the Jews, as he noted in the chorus he composed for the Hebrew slaves in Nabucco, atheist Verdi died, and the great Toscanini arranged for 850 performers to sing at his funeral. What excitement! What drama, as only Italians can give us. Now, let us have more, as our journey begins with my novel, Bella Figura, set where else but the magical, mystical land of Capri, the island that's a jewel set majestically that punctuates the beginning of the breathtaking Amalfi Coast. It's on the southern coast of Italy. From here, one can see mighty Vesuvius dominating the Bay of Naples. It's here, a short distance away, you'll find Pompeii, Paestum, and Sorrento. Magic happens in Capri, and I hope some of you in this audience have been there. And for those of you who haven't, let this be the initiation of your trip. Poets, writers, and painters have recorded the unique beauty of Capri forever. Legends have spun about mythical heroes, gods of the universe and sirens of the sea, that came to call with ancient mysteries. And what Italians do best? Drama, Italian style. History tells us the Emperor Augustus was intoxicated by the island's mystique. It was here Ulysses tried the herb from the god Hermes as the antidote to the spell of Circe. And here Virgil spoke about the 20 wives he left behind because a nymph bore Telon a son. Historian Suetonius accounts the Augustan age on the Imperial Isle, recalling he was so taken by the geography, climate, and beauty of Capri, he exchanged his private domain, Ischia, the larger neighboring island, with the Republic of Naples for Capri. He sensed the paradise he was searching for was uniquely there, the jewel in his imperial crown. Sumptuous villas were built, temples were popping up here, there, and everywhere all over the island. And Villa Jovis, which one can visit today, became the home to Emperor Tiberius, his successor and adopted stepson. Tiberius, an anti-Semite, prejudiced against women, an aristocrat and a general, was a complex individual, and he gave the importance to Capri to be the second Palatine of the Imperial Rome. He ruled the Roman Empire 23 years, and his move from Rome to Capri with his entourage made the Neapolitan philosopher Bovio write, "The law of the world is conceived in Capri, sold in Rome, and imposed upon the whole earth." The House of the Caesars brought literary assemblies and individuals of remarkable quality to congregate and pay tribute to Tiberius. The Bay of Naples was splendid. Vesuvius was yet to erupt. And Tiberius's bella figura at 77 was robust. He was going to javelin tournaments and stalking wild deer. Nevertheless, fate has a way of playing with our lives. He caught chill. Right at the time, he was at a boar hunt and learned that Pontius Pilate had found this certain Jesus Christ who claimed he was the king of the Jews and had crucified him in Jerusalem. And secondly, on Capri, a one and only earthquake brought evil to call with an omen so severe it precipitated the collapse of the Roman Empire. Feverish and shivering, he was taken to a sumptuous villa on the mainland, and it happened that Caligula, his grandnephew and adopted grandson, was there. Caligula, seeing his chance for power, facilitated death by smothering Tiberius while he was sleeping with a pillow. Tiberius never dreamed Caligula would betray him, evidenced by the fact that months earlier he bequeathed his empire to him and his biological grandson. Once Tiberius was dead, Caligula made sure his will was totally annulled and his stepson executed. Well, we all know what wills can do, and the last will and testament of Tiberius was no different than everybody else's. These harrowing events brought the end to Imperial Capri, until 500 years later, when the Ottoman pirate Barbarossa, a Muslim, seized the island, capturing it. The inhabitants were petrified, and they ran to the hills and to a castle the Duke of Amalfi had built, 1,352 feet above sea level. That gave Barbarossa his chance to loot the most wealthy kingdom in all of Europe, Naples, and then come back and cause havoc to the poor Caprese. You can visit this ruin if you have the stamina to climb, and is now called uniquely Barbarossa's Castle. With the passage of time, all became peaceful, as best described by Goethe's poem 200 years later, detailing where we're about to go, Capri. You know that land where lemon orchards bloom, its golden oranges aglow in gloom? That land of soft wind blowing from a blue sky, where myrtle hushes and the laurels sigh? You know that land, that way, that way? I'd go with you, and I'd go today. My love, come with me and come today. And now, says the narrator, with a scenario that echoes history, my story begins in 2004. For too many years, confesses the narrator, I've postponed telling this story. Know that with all the beauty in this world, the ugliness of prejudice rears its head and is best kept suppressed with political correctness. What I write, he states, is not an invention. The bias of class, religion, race, gender, age, and nationality are subjects that stir one's heart, one's mind, and one's conscience. No one is without prejudice. Suspend judgment until the end of the epic event that you will read about in the life of Esmeralda Pembroke, a woman, a legend, who astonished everyone whose life was entwined with hers. Esmeralda is a woman without fear, except the fear of disclosure. She's done everything to be in the position she's achieved, but what is the mystery that she hides? What about this woman, or woman in general? Henry James, in his Portrait of a Lady, states, the soul is inseparable from clothes and acquisitions. You'll see that every human being has his shell, and that you must take into account his shell when you view him. Bella figura, how people walk, stand, sit, speak, all clues to behavior. Rarely wrong. Imagine, if you will, Villapina, set on the highest part of Capri where it meets with Anna Capri, framed with the panorama of unsurpassed beauty, the Mediterranean. This sumptuous home, adorned with an unsurpassed art collection, was bequeathed to the biotech heiress Esmeralda by her beloved Count Gianni Ziani, whose legacy included giving her Ziani Pharmaceuticals International, the huge multinational conglomerate that dominates Europe and Asia. She wed him after a trajectory that took her from her birth in South Africa to a remarkable career in London. In the land of tea time, so different from her original setting, Johannesburg, and that of her current place, Capri, her remarkable beauty, much like Botticelli's Venus, brings love, riches, fame, fortune, knowledge, and a view of the world, a big, wide, wonderful world. And yet, as Esmeralda matures, she's taught by society, by teachers, by experience to form her view of life and the joy of life, with its detours, meets unexpected surprises that my protagonist, a woman of daring and character, manages to share with us. We know other people impose prejudices early in the life of innocent children that change their entire structure of thinking. Somewhere along the way, we take in the thoughts of others, the teachings of professors, religious leaders, our lovers, our friends, or a political situation that forms the work of art that we call ourselves. You've got to be taught Before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate everyone your family hates, you've got to be carefully taught. Those are the wonderful words of Oscar Hammerstein, and no one could say it better. Thank you so much. Grazie tanti. Today, more than ever, we have a huge socioeconomic divide. Prejudice looms everywhere. Secretary of State Kerry has just formed a department that will address bigotry between religious groups. Not since the 18th century, writes the London Literary Review, have writers been so nervous about causing offense to the followers of a religion. While from the Vatican, the nuns cite censorship. The church says it's taboo for them to be priests. And we're relegated to second class citizens, they say. Oh, women, dynamic women, and impoverished females. In America, every 3 minutes, a woman is raped. In South Africa, every 6 seconds. In Muslim countries, they suffer sexual mutilation. 1 in 3 homes in America has domestic violence. Yet there are more mega millionaires and billionaires than ever before. By 2030, starvation will be rampant in Africa. Yet, Manolo Blahnik sandals will cost $2,500. That is $1,000 more than we're paying today. Where is all this going? With social networking, everybody wants to be a wannabe. Everyone has a voice, and everybody wants one kind of a voice, a bella figura voice. Strides have been made for tolerance and acceptance for women, gays, black, Latinos, young people, old people, transgender people, Jews, Muslims, Christians, but that word but. With the best of intentions, decisions are made that realign our tomorrow. And in Esmeralda's case, she inherits a fortune, and she also inherits secrets. From this stems her idea to launch a blockbuster of a film that will take the spotlight away from her and focus on a thriller of a movie that will be another wise investment for her portfolio. To launch the film, Esmeralda invites a potpourri of 20 glittering VIPs from around the world, the movers and the shakers of society, to her villa. It is here when the unexpected happens. Blackmail. It is eruption like a volcano. A curse is put upon Esmeralda, and curses are what stirred Verdi to write, as he did with pure emotion. I promised to take you to Capri, and now I want you to imagine you're there. At the time of the afternoon in Capri, Marinda, the Italians call it, there came a monotonous hoot of an owl who saw everything and spoke a language only birds could decipher. He positioned himself hidden in the ramparts of the roof. His continual hoot, hoot, seemed a warning of imminent danger. The place he lingered was covered with bougainvillea, an intoxicating honeysuckle that made his constant sound heard by everyone in the villa. He wanted to take this chance and make his existence known. Hoot, hoot. Was it a signal? Was it a message? At the last beam of sunset, the owl's profile could be seen in the crumbling column by the sea. Hoot, hoot, hoot. By midnight, he flew off, stretching his wings to the sky. His silhouette was spotted a brief second against the half moon. Perhaps the mermaid Circe called him where he wanted to be. The gentle tide murmured, and like the wind died down as a bevy of starlings swooped in a magical dance between the pine trees at Villa Pina. Then all was quiet. Silence. Even the cicadas and that haunting hoot of the owl was never, never heard again. Silence like this, one can only experience in Capri. Nature sends mystic messages to this isle in a strange way. On this night, as a canopy of stars twinkled above, before life was to arrive at dawn, bliss descended on this paradise. Never could one imagine the secret that was to come. Within hours, havoc would descend upon Vilipina. People of diverse backgrounds mingling at Vilipina demonstrate the undercurrent of life, true life, as we hear it, and we don't wish to magnify it. Each guest learns about Esmeralda's hidden past. Prejudices loom over what was a beautiful scarlet sunset in Capri. A theme of intrigue, greed, and prejudice percolate, yet summer love also blooms from some of the other people at the villa. And they all seek one thing, Bella Figura, while they're whispering. Lies, prejudices, creating conspiracies, and at the same time enjoying the luxurious life Esmeralda presents, saying one thing and doing another. Bella Figura, proclaims Englishman Esmeralda's present husband, Nigel Pembroke. He is a person with class bias. How people act to gain respect and recognition. Sounds like my Esmeralda. At the height of Esmeralda's success, mid-story, as the truth surfaces, it's diabolical. How all react will focus the reader's own value system. Everyone has secrets, says Esmeralda. All is rosy when milk and honey abound, but what about the reverse? What will people do when threatened? When their sphere of comfort shifts 1 inch? When a person of another race, religion, age, or diverse gender intersects our territorial radar? Bias, bias, bias is everywhere, including age bias and success bias. Age bias either way. The whirlpool of a decision doesn't give advanced knowledge how destiny dictates life. No one knows how they will react and what deep-seated feelings will be theirs and what it means to survive in the storm of life. Yet at the end, everybody wants one thing, to be remembered and to work and be always showing Bella Figura throughout their lives. Through Esmeralda's genius, she endures fate that confronts her. While others jeer, still others succeed, and others walk away, whether quietly or with an uproar to have their say. The plot of my novel takes a dramatic twist at the end. An unexpected finale arrives that the narrator makes himself heard. His loyalty, tactics, and love have the power to change life. Family ties and philosophy that shifts thinking, realigns fortunes, and a future that sets the tone for us all. So now, while I sign books for you very kind people who've made a beautiful effort to be here this evening, and my radio audience goes to Books Incorporated, Book Passage, or Amazon to get a copy, I will do what I should always do. I'm putting on my rose-colored glasses. And I will say, as I put them on, let the drama of life begin. And wherever we are, whether we are in romantic Capri, listening to that hoot of the owl, or whether we are here on a May evening in San Francisco at the very important Commonwealth Club, I hope that you come away with a message in my novel. And I hope, long after you finish the last page, you'll remember this. Thank you for being an audience full of Bella Figura. Buonasera.
Radio and online audiences that they're listening to Jojo Capiz, the author of Bella Figura, speaking about her brand new novel. And it's time for questions and answers. Who would like to ask the first question?
What do you really think of Berlusconi?
I think Berlusconi, as I said in my book, All Roads Lead to Rome, is one of the extraordinary characters of today. I think he has $6 billion that uniquely came from being a door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman to the former Prime Minister of Italy. I don't think we can ignore this man. I think also it's very interesting. I have my very charming Italian cousin in the audience, and while I was in Naples with some of our relatives, one clever relative said, "What do you mean the girl was 17? She was 17 and 10 months, and her mother dressed her up and pushed her to the party because she wanted her to meet the prime minister. Could have helped the family." So, of course, we get things through the press. He's no angel. I think when Monty came in, I said it in my book in a more gentle way. I said to my husband, he will do the laundry. And that's exactly what Italians don't do austerity very well. And Letta, I wish him a lot of good luck, who is now acting prime minister. And the mayor of Florence, who was a chap in his 40s, Lenzi, is, I think, with a chance. I'm very happy that Beppe Grillo, who was terribly vulgar, has been dismissed because he wouldn't work with people. And Italy is, was, and will be. I'm not worried about Italy. It is still my favorite country to visit. I think many people feel the same way. And there's a drama. There's a drama when you go buy three slices of prosciutto in the Alimentaria. There's always a drama in Italy. And so Berlusconi, who I have met, who's the tiny little thing, he's quite a character. And I don't think we should nail him to the cross, but I think when you read my previous book, one has to take into consideration, just like when Andreotti died, between that book and this one, there is the kaleidoscope of the Italian network of power, which I discussed in my first book. And that takes in the five components of the judges, the mafia, the CIA, the Vatican, and of course, Propaganda Due, the Masonic order. And these things don't go away. You're not going to make someone who is a person born in Thailand do a Mexican hat dance. Even if they marry a Mexican, they'll try it, but they're not going to be as good as the person born in Mexico. So I think we have great diversity in the world. My book, this new book, is about diversity and how we accept diversity. This evening, here I am, a woman who is very boring, perhaps, because I'm a woman of a certain age. And in the next room is a gentleman speaking about the Arab world. So I am speaking of a European and Western world, our world. And so I think that is very exciting. And I wish Italy the best. I truly do.
Do you think he's going to win again?
I don't think he's going to go away. I always said that he has one great friend, and that's his plastic surgeon. And I'm happy to tell you his plastic surgeon is from San Francisco. And he flies out to take care of Silvio and maybe his many different girls that he has. But he was telling me one day when we were talking, because he's been very supportive of my book, he said, Silvio wants the best for Italy. And he's very Italian. And I think that, I mean, if somebody asked me, would you rather have dinner with Berlusconi or sit down and have dinner with Monty? Heck, it would be much more exciting to have dinner with Berlusconi. So that's just me. Yes?
How do you think the concept of bella figura should inspire other women?
Thank you for that question.
Could you repeat it?
How do you think that the concept of bella figura should inspire other women?
I think one of the most powerful forces in the world is femininity. And my heart breaks because so much of it is being swept aside by the fashion designers, by people who are afraid to be feminine because of society. And I see it in my own life. As soon as I let my anima come, and I'm gentle and kind with my husband, He is putty in my hands, and if I let my animus show and I become a woman of today, I'm bucking a San Francisco cowboy that is not really who I want to buck with. So the thing is that I do think that women have to try to keep our femininity, and that's Bella Figura. Everything a woman does, I've stopped when somebody will be at a door. These poor fellows don't know if they should open a door for a woman or not anymore. And I'll stop, and then they'll open it, and I said, "That is marvelous. You're such a gentleman." He said, "I didn't know what to do." And I said, "Thank you. You're really a gentleman." And they just sort of dissolve. They're so happy for that experience. So I think, and it's very hard for girls today, and I know I'm speaking to two wonderful girls who are at the dynamic high-tech company Square that gave me a fabulous book party. And I've had the pleasure to be down there and see young people's minds that are 30 and under. And women are confronted with things that we were not confronted with today. It's almost being superwoman and still keeping that femininity, but God bless you, keep it.
Very good. Well, that's a great topic, actually, to go into a little bit further, Jojo, because it seems to me that we're right at the start of this liberation, although it's been going on for over 100 years, but it's still right at the start, and everyone doesn't know what to keep and what to do. But your good comment about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, there's really no reason. But I think one of the economic things that there is that you'll find over the next 100 years is that the countries and the economies that use their female resources are going to have an advantage, an economic advantage, a long-term economic advantage that will show over time. And there's already clear from some of the countries that have advanced economies but don't use their women that they are losing ground to the ones that do.
Absolutely.
So I think that's one thing that will, you know, make a big difference over time.
I think so. I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm thrilled to see some of the women in high tech who are trying to balance it, Marissa Mayer and the gal from Facebook, also Kamala Harris, political figure. And so I think we onward number. I had the joy of working with Madam Thatcher, and she was a tiger. She was very strong, but she always looked divine. I never saw her in any way ever without looking very well kept, very feminine, and she was very kind to her husband, Dennis, who was a unique character. It takes also strong men who believe in themselves to be able to support a woman who wants to have her career opportunity and not lose his power. So it's like a seesaw, and God bless my little grandson who's 8 months old. I hope he finds a dynamic woman, but I don't want him to be down on the seesaw. I want him to be up on the seesaw.
I think you can tell how deep an inroad this has made into our culture, that even politicians are marrying intelligent women with their own careers, because usually they want someone that just stands there and admires them. That has been the historical thing. But if you went through the wives of the current senators and top people, I think that has been one of the big sea changes. So that shows how deep it's gone into society.
I think even our lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, his wife, who is a mother of little tiny children and is always looking beautiful, she has made a real impact in the movie business that is totally separate from what Gavin does. He supported her, she supported him, and I admire them enormously because they are really sort of a young couple of today. And I think we have to see more of that.
And I think we will. So, next question. Anybody have a question about? Okay.
I'm not sure that all of the serious questions have been asked, but I didn't want to leave here without asking you this question. When you want to eat good Italian food, where do you go in San Francisco?
Great question.
It's a great question. Besides my house, it was really nice. When I launched All Roads Lead to Rome, CBS TV Morning News asked me to come on, and they asked me the same question. And the oldest Italian restaurant in town is Fiori d'Italia. And Johnny is the chef, and the food is extraordinary. then the poor Johnny lost the license or something, but he rebought it, and it's reopened again. And it really is a great Italian restaurant. There's Farina, there are several others, but the ambience at Fiore dell'Italia is something in North Beach that you can go in and just say, I want a veal scallopini, make it the best way. You don't have to tell him, and he'll do that. And I think we're lucky to have two great alimentarias. We have Molinari, and we have a place on Chestnut Street, Luca, and that place has wonderful things to take away so you can cook at home. And I know Italian food is hard to get here because we don't really want to flavor it with so much garlic and cilantro. And they get sometimes confused, the Mexican with the Italian. But we have different regions. And my mother was very Florentine, a Venetian and Florentine, and my father was very Neapolitan. And so they would always argue about which food was better. And then you get someone from Bologna who's going to say, no, it's all Bolognese food. That's the only kind of food. So it's very, very interesting.
Another question.
Who do you hope this book gets into the hands of?
It's a very nice question. Well, first of all of you. And I would love to see this book as either a TV special series or film. I think the protagonist is that complicated, and of course, at the end, you'll come to understand her story. And so I would love for it to get into the right hands of somebody like that. That's a dream come true. And from your question to my lips to God's ears.
I have a question for you, Jojo. What made you decide to become a novelist when you were 40 years old?
Well, no, it wasn't 40. When I was 8, I am a New Yorker. You could probably tell by my little twang in my voice. And, of course, New York kids get sent away to camp or they go away to a summer house. And that was my childhood growing up. And always, I was in my little belongings, where my most favorite possession were Grimm's fairy tales. And I remember not being able to read Grimm's fairy tales and then asking them to be read to me so that I could memorize every single story. And being Italian, I had a couple of melodramatic aunts that always told great stories. And we did not have television. We had radio. And it wasn't until I think I was 10 or 12 that we actually had a television set. And that was great because then we had to either write our own stories and draw pictures, or we had to interact with a hated sister or a beloved cousin when we did, for example, the nativity scene. You know, I was never the Madonna. I was always some angel. I always got second billing. But I think that started it. So I started writing, and I didn't really develop my writing, although I had a great joy of having some very important writers in my life. And I was single a long time before I married my husband, Ed. This book is dedicated to Ed. And that propelled me to concentrate on my writing. And then once wed, and after he had a couple of years of honeymoon, I told him, now you're going to have to give me some hours to myself. I want to publish and write. So that's how it happened.
That's fantastic. And did you find it to be as enjoyable as you'd anticipated all that time, or?
I think writing. I had a couple of other careers. I do paint and I sculpt. Writing is much more challenging because anybody can come and blue pencil your writing. Nobody's really going to come up to a painting or a piece of sculpture and say, you know, the hand is wrong or the nose is wrong. But people love to put a blue line through your work, including my husband. And so, quite frankly, I really think that if a higher power is with me, and I write something that I know in my heart is good, perhaps you enjoyed my Hoot of the Owl. I found that to be a moment where I was very happy with that writing. And it's plenty that gets thrown away.
but you came out with your second novel so quickly after your first novel.
Actually, this novel was written, the spine of this novel was written in Capri in 2005. And it was put aside. Random House in the UK wanted me to change the protagonist. I didn't want to do it. And that broke my heart, but they liked the way I wrote. And then I had this extraordinary destiny to come to this country and meet my husband and get married. And in the course from 2005 to 2008, when I actually married my husband, I was in Capri many times and wrote in Capri. And then the book was pretty well finished at a beach house in St. Augustine, Florida. And that was a wonderful experience because I was there all by myself. My children came down and visited me on occasion. And I finished the novel. And once I married Ed and knew I wanted to publish this, I did change it slightly, but not too much.
Great story. All right, another question. Who else has a question? Peter.
Allow me to ask, do you find writing to be a very therapeutic process?
It could be cathartic if you're writing your diary. It could be cathartic if you are troubled and you feel you have to expel something. Imaginative writing is also traveling with your own fantasy. To me, writing a novel is separate from writing a diary. I keep a diary every day. I have since I was 10. And that helps me because as I'm getting senior moments, every now and then I go back to the diaries and they have everything there.
How many people in the audience do that? They're trying to look back maybe and trying to write about their time? Think about it. Yes, everybody does that. Anybody else trying to write?
Yeah, I'm writing my life story as well.
Right.
And my ancestors.
I think that's a wonderful idea. And I have been writing my true memoir, and then it's already titled, and I believe that's something nice that you can give your children and grandchildren. No one else has to read it. I might never really publish this. Exactly.
You know, I was talking to someone today, and he was talking about his grandfather was police chief of Chicago in the end of the 19th century. But he knows almost nothing about his life. And I think that was true for a lot of grandparents and parents kept their stories to themselves. Did anybody get down the information about their grandparents' lives? Did anybody hear that in their lives? The younger people say yes, but how about Dick also?
It's interesting. My husband's yeah. Mother never wrote anything. Mm-hmm. She was a dynamic woman, a very interesting woman for me to put in a novel. But his stepfather wrote and wrote and wrote. And I've said to my husband, Ed, you have to be careful because this is a one corridor story. Mm-hmm. And that's important. I think when you write family stories, it's very important to take in, we are generally with two sets of grandparents. That's, you know, four different personalities. And this book has a number of characters in that eventually they all fall into place. But I think that's what happens. You never knew about your Aunt Teresa, and then you found out about Uncle Marco, who had an affair with somebody that we don't want to mention in the family, and that was all hush-hush. Or or somebody who, you know, wanted to be a nun and were denied that privilege and had to end up doing something else. So there are sort of secret stories in families. Every family has secrets. Everybody has a story within them. And I had one lovely gal who said to me, Jojo, if you ever knew the real story, I'd love you to write it for me. And I said, you really should try to write it yourself. So, you know, there we are.
I found from some people who just can't put pen to paper and write that their children sometimes have gotten them to talk for an hour or two and recorded it and then passed it on later on. And that has also been very good both for the parents and for the next generations because it's an easy way to get some of the stories, at least, you know, the filtered down anecdotes. It comes down to 25 anecdotes. But if you look at it, if you look at the history of biography and the people who are very good at writing biographies, the whole thing about the biography is what anecdotes you choose to tell. That are they broad enough and diverse enough that capture different aspects of that person's life? You can make anybody look like a demon, like Berlusconi, with 10 anecdotes. And you can make anybody look like a saint. It might be a little bit hard with 10 anecdotes about Berlusconi, but you know, you can make almost anybody be at polar opposites, even from their own life. But the great biographers are the ones who absorb the whole life and then pick out the anecdotes that are telling about that person at each point in their life so that you get a really feel for the man.
Because we both have, we have in each of us a bright side and a dark side. And it's interesting to take the dark side and not be afraid of it, but consider it, because it's usually the side of you that's very deep. And it might be bruta figura, but sometimes it's interesting. I think a granddaughter or a great-grandchild would be more interested to find out about the naughty things you did instead of, you know, the good things that you always wore white gloves and went to church every Sunday. I mean, you know, that could be a little monotonous. But
it's not even just monotonous. I think that especially if you've been a successful person, your granddaughter is sitting at 19 years of age and saying, how am I going to be as successful as my grand because I have this weakness? And if they don't find you had any weaknesses, they don't know how you did it. I always use this in culture because people say, well, if we get our culture organized well and we get politicians that are honest, then we can really accomplish something. But everything that's been accomplished in human history has been done in the middle of a mess with bad politicians and dishonest people in religious positions and so on. That's the way everything has always been. So accomplishments don't take place when you finally got everything organized. You don't have to wait for that. And I think it's a shame to the next generations to give the impression that we are, you know, we're simpler. I find it very interesting about baby boom generation worried about the bad things that their kids are going to do when they go to college. They just remember, you know.
But we have to remember that our young people live in the world of tomorrow, and we are not in the world of tomorrow.
I am writing about the things my grandchildren tell me or say for them when they are grown-ups. And, for instance, my granddaughter, who is 3, somebody asked her, what's your name, little girl? And she said, Trouble. Things of that sort. And when we were at the Louvre Museum recently for Easter, the boys asked, why all these statues do not have underpants?
It's from the mouths of babes, oftentimes from gems.
Those are the things I'm writing about.
Exactly. It would be a very cute book, illustrated too, could be a charming thing to have, exactly.
Well, we have time for one or two more questions. Would anybody like to ask one of the last couple of questions here?
I have a comment for you.
Okay, great, Bill.
I think there's an outfit, I think it's called Storybrook. Have you heard of this? It's the Library of Congress, and you sit down, and you have to pay, but I think it's $200 or something, and they let you talk for an hour and a half about your life, and then you get a transcript, and it goes to the Library of Congress. So if anybody here wants to talk, they don't want to write, but they want their grandchildren to know about themselves. I think it's called Storybook. My stepson did it for me. It's very interesting.
That's a great idea. Has anybody been at Ellis Island where they collected all those stories? Because that's also a really great presentation of all the different people coming through. Okay, one last question. How did you pick Botticelli to be the image of your now.
I think it's quite amazing. This painting was done in 1453. I was walking down Union Street, and a girl confronted me. Of course, she had jeans on and a sweater. It was the Botticelli Venus. I stopped her, and I pulled out one of my promotional cards, and I said, look at this. This is a most remarkable painting, because this is a painting of a naked woman, and there is no message of anything except beauty. That is not vulgar. Everyone embraces this beautiful, beautiful woman. We have put her, you see, in Capri. It is not the full painting. It's a variation of the painting. And when you read the story, you'll know why I selected her. On the back is an image of Caesar taken from the highest point of, let's say, our Villa Pina, where Capri meets Anna Capri, and he's overlooking the beautiful Amalfi Coast. And that was a gift to me from the Hotel Cesare Augustus. There is a chapter when she goes to the Hotel Cesare Augustus, and the owner was very kind. He was very excited about it, and I said, I'd love to use the photo, and he did let me use it. So they're very compatible. I will say this, because this book also deals with prejudice and bias. When Botticelli was an established painter and made magnificent works of art, there was a monk in Florence named Savonarola, and he had such power over people who were artistically gifted that he could tell them what they were painting was wrong, and the person had to throw it into his bonfires of the vanities. I am so sorry to say Botticelli fell victim to the monk, and a lot of his works he himself had burned, believing they were too erotic. But this extraordinary work and some of his others, the Uffizi and some other places, thank God, was saved from the madness of that monk who had such terrible prejudice. So that's an interesting story, because who was this wonderful woman? And I like to think she was Esmeralda, but who was she in 1453? Well, and also, you see, that was 100 years before Barbarossa came and took control of the Kingdom of Naples. So the Ottoman Empire was very powerful. Cute story about the Ottoman Empire. They believed the only people who could make contracts with the Western world were the Italians. So they trusted the Italian lawyers, which I think is very charming, and that's a fact that's published in a book, the Washington Post writer.
It's amazing how that has lasted all the way to today. Yeah. Well, that's a great way to...
Baton?
One more question?
Yeah, I always thought, and maybe I'm wrong, that Bella Figura was dual. You put on sort of a mask of a Bella Figura, and once you scrapped it a little bit, you saw something totally
like a varnish.
Different.
That's why I said it's the impression.
Like the Japanese, you know, well, not to lose face.
Well, it's just, my dear friend, it's the impression you give. And tonight, when you go home and you are cuddling up with your sweetheart or thinking about tonight's program, you're going to say, I remember JoJo. And I remember she had this sort of varnish of her rose-colored glasses. And her white gloves. But of course, we must say Bella Figura is not exactly your natural state. It's what they teach babies and what they teach people to have the best impression possible. So, you're right. It's a varnish.
Well, that certainly was a great presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California. in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.